It's about planning the long game. Creating a movement doesn't happen with just doing one talk. Creating a movement is a whole series of stories, ceremonies, symbols, and speeches, and over and over and over. It's the long game. And and for me, it's been the long game. And I'm going to stay committed to this. You know, presenting well is like my cause. And it's just been so fun to see the transformation in space.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Today, we continue our Best of 2016 series, and if you're looking for a stocking stuffer for a friend or family member, Unmistakable, Why Only is Better Than Best, is now on sale for a discount price of just $14.04. And as always, today's episode is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. So if you have an unmistakable project that you're looking to start, build a website, and if you're not ready to do that, just register a domain. And HostGator is fantastic for helping you to get started because they provide 30% off all of their hosting packages for Unmistakable Creative listeners. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy, and by using the promo code, you get 30% off all of their hosting packages. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Nancy, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, it is really cool to have you here. You know, as I was saying to you before we actually hit record here, the work that you and Gar Reynolds have done around presentations have deeply informed my own work around speeches and presentations. Like, I literally sit down with your books before every single talk I do to make sure that my slides don't suck. So it is a pleasure to have you here. And on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your background, and how that has led you to all the work that you're doing today?
You know, I get this question sometimes. I think people think that I, you know, was born knowing I wanted to be a presentation specialist, you know, and I actually feel like in some ways presentations found me. I actually, one of my dirty secrets is I was kind of raised in this economically and emotionally starved environment, and I dropped out of college because it was just too hard. I got a C minus in speech communications in college. I got a D in English. In speech communications, I actually got an F in being able to connect effectively with the audience. And if you look at my body of work, that failure, you know, almost like proving to that teacher that I do know how to connect to the audience, is what sparked my body of work. And, you know, you as a someone, especially in the Silicon Valley, being a white female with an Hispanic surname in the Silicon Valley with no degree, you know, I'm like the antithesis. I've become the antithesis of what my destiny maybe would have dictated I become. And, you know, we just started this little tiny firm, and my husband actually started it. He just wanted to kind of work at home with the kids underfoot. And that was 1988. And believe it or not, exactly 25 years after he moved furniture, he spent a whole summer moving furniture from a company that was failing here in the Valley. And he moved furniture all summer and bought a little tiny Mac Plus in 1988. And we moved into that very same building he moved furniture from 25 years ago. It's a 35,000 square foot, beautiful, sparkly, pretty building. And it's just a dream. He's like, Nancy, if I had an open vision 25 years ago when I was schlepping furniture that we would be in this building, it would have freaked me out. Like, I would have run. You know, it's just overwhelming sometimes. And yet here we are. And my husband and I have always had this belief system that if you wake up every day and do what brings you peace and do what brings you passion, you'll end up at the right place, you know. And I feel like that's kind of what we did every day, not realizing that something like this big company would be, you know, our destiny. It's all worked out.
So that raises a number of questions, as you might imagine. When you look back at your life, even prior to dropping out of college, like parents, mentors, influences, mm-hmm. are there events or experiences that you think ultimately planted seeds for how you ended up having presentations find you?
Yeah, you know, my husband and I, we were just on vacation. I had my first what I would call real vacation a couple of weeks ago. And we were talking about, how did you play as children? Like, how did you play? You know, and he was typical. Oh, we did sports and we speared rats on the fence and, you know, just like play, like boy play. And I said, wow, that's funny. I sat at a little desk and traced things out of coloring books and filed them. I played Monopoly. I played Risk. Like, I didn't do kind of those typical things. My version of play looked a lot like entrepreneurship. And as I grew up, I think one of the most formidable influences in my life was my mother, in that she wasn't readily present. And my mom was a bit of a cocktail of excitement because she's actually a narcissist and she has border personality disorder and is bipolar. And so a lot of my childhood, I just wanted to be seen by her. I wanted to be noticed. I wanted her to see that I existed or that could, you know, was she proud of me? Was a very big thing I wanted to hear from my mom. And that became a lot of a driving force inside of me. Like, oh, maybe if I do this great thing, she'll notice me. You know, maybe, oh, what if I tell her about this thing? Maybe she'll say, good job, or, you know. And so that was almost like the fuel for a long time that fueled me. Now I'm over it, right? But for a long time early in my drive, my season of being driven, it was that. But oddly, it wasn't until when I joined my husband in 1990 here, we won a division of Apple. And Apple was the first company that hooked up projectors at scale to the computer. You got to realize that before then, my husband and I made actual 35 millimeter slides. We actually physically printed them in our apartment. And what happened was Apple in 92, they had a huge layoff and all of those people that were used to us doing their slides for them, you know, scattered all over the Bay Area and took us with them. And the phone just kept ringing and ringing for presentations. We tried really hard to not be a presentation company. We did web and print and multimedia, and we tried to hide presentations. Mm-hmm. And then the dot-com crash happened, and everyone kept calling for their presentations. All the web, multimedia, print work went away. People kept calling for presentations. And at the same time, Jim Collins' book, Good to Great, came out. And he said, if there's one thing you can do that you could be best in the world at, be passionate about, be profitable about, do that, just that one thing. Be profitable. And that's what we did. So here it is. The economy's tanking. It's crashing. We decide to shutter 3 out of 4 of our services and focus on just one. Super counterintuitive move, but it was the best thing I ever did. And I just think that there's moments in time that are tests, you know, where you test your heart, it tests your grit. And I think I've had all of those, you know, and we just chose to focus on it because it was what the phone rang. And then by focusing on it, we became experts. So that's like how it happened as you tumble through time here.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that's really interesting is that you mentioned that you did terrible in speech and communication of all things. And now you've built this career and become sort of the go-to person for this very thing. What I think is really interesting, though, is the kind of identity transition that needs to occur internally in order to have that. I mean, that's significant. That's almost literally a 180-degree transition. Yeah. I'm wondering what enables that in a person and a human being.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, because when, you know, my poor kids, whenever they're, it comes up and I'm like, oh, that reminds me of a story from my childhood, they'll always be like, Mom, we're not in the mood to be sad right now. And I thought, how funny that when people hear my story, they're like, why, how did you become what you are? And I don't know why, but some people, when they go through hardship, they become victims. They feel like this is happening to me versus rising and saying, well, this is an interesting challenge, you know? And I don't know why, I've always just been resilient and looked at things from, you know, abuse and neglect and all those things to, hey, I know I don't want that, so I'm going to go become this other thing, you know, and just kind of took it as a challenge. And what the great thing is, it's so fun that 2 years ago, I guess it's been 2 years ago, yeah, the university that where I failed out of or I dropped out of, they gave me Entrepreneur of the Year award, and it's gone to people like Ross Perot and all the other people, and they give it to me. And I just thought, wow, that's like closure in my heart. Cisco, my client, they paid for me to get an MBA from UCLA. So that hole that was in my heart, or that hole that would tell me every day, you have this void, you're a poser, you're faking, you know, those kinds of lies we tell ourselves that are, you know, we try to knock ourselves down, you know, these lies we tell ourselves, all those kind of lies got closed in my heart because of these things, these moments that happened to me that said, no, you are the real deal. It doesn't matter that you didn't get a degree, you know. And then Cisco swooped in with the UCLA MBA program, and I was just like, oh my god, I can't believe all this just happened. So life isn't all rosy, but I think life is what you make it, and I've always tried to take everything as a fresh challenge and a new thing to learn and overcome.
Do you think everybody has that capability to take an experience that has happened to them and instead of becoming a victim to it, make a positive change from it? And if so, how?
I do. I think it's just a choice and a mindset. You know, my husband was diagnosed with cancer, and now we've tried to cure it 3 times. But we're so excited about life. We don't, you know, not that we don't care, but it's like, how, you know, we could hole away in the fetal position and cry under our pillow, or live life to its fullest. You know, and we've had hard things happen, and we've had glorious things happen, and we just try to be fully present every day and not take on a pitiful, self-focused, narcissistic mindset, and work hard at making sure we understand that in every obstacle is an opportunity.
One of the things that's really interesting to me about your story is that it seems like what we know you for started well after almost 25 years of working at what you do. And that's a long time, you know, to persist at something. And I'm just curious, you know, one, how you've developed that level of persistence, that level of grit, and how people do that in their own lives. Because I think that in the world that we live in, and I wrote this in my book, I said that our perception of longevity is incredibly warped because the world moves at breakneck speeds. And yep. Where that came from was a lecture I heard Sam Altman give during the Y Combinator Startup School series that they made available via podcast. He said, you know, a long-term view is your greatest competitive advantage because so few people have one.
I love that. Yeah, it's funny. We were in business 20 years before my first book was written. And I think it wasn't until we focused on presentations and I really got my sea legs and I started to look around and be like, we might be the experts in the world at this, you know? And my son wound up, he's super gifted, and he wound up going away to high school to the East Coast because he's a musical prodigy. And he became an empty nest. I became an empty nester 3 years sooner than I thought. Now, while my kids were growing up, I got one REM cycle of sleep. I slept from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. For about a decade. And that's what I had to do to be a mom, to be present, and to be an entrepreneur with a very vastly quickly growing business. We grew 25% a year for 20 years. And that was hard. It was hard, but it was easy in the same sense because I loved what I did and I wanted to make the sacrifice to be there for my kids. So it was like, it took a lot of discipline and keeping my hand to the plow. And then I brought in a president, 2006. I'll never forget. It was like, I brought him in, he started to run the place, and I thought, I need to go on a journey of my soul. I need to know, now that I'm not having to be caught up in the day-to-day of this business, what do I want to do? And that's when I decided to write the book and just put my body of work out there for the world to judge and see where it goes. And now I'm kind of hooked, right? I just finished this new one, and which is a lot about the comment you just made on longevity. It's about planning the long game. Creating a movement doesn't happen with just doing one talk. Creating a movement is a whole series of stories, ceremonies, symbols, and speeches, and over and over and over. It's the long game. And for me, it's been the long game. And I'm going to stay committed to this. You know, presenting well is like my cause. And it's just been so fun to see the transformation in the space.
So I have one more question about the earlier part of this. You know, you mentioned that you have this sort of hole in your heart from wanting parental approval. And the reason I ask this question is because I think I still have it, you know, especially coming from an Indian family. And my sister is the chief anesthesiology resident at Yale. So she's done everything like a good Indian kid should do. And I'm
DNA probably.
Yeah. And I'm like the polar opposite. Like I jokingly was telling my business partner, I think that God made a sorting error at the hospital when I was born. So I'm just curious how, you know, you go about resolving that in your life if you haven't yet.
Yeah. You know what? It was about when I was at home for 16 years when my mom was there. She wound up leaving us when I was 16. When I was celebrating my 16-year anniversary, I realized, wait a minute, I've been away from my mom as long as I was with her. How long does it take you to get over this, right? And I made a decision that I'm just going to be over it and realize, just accept, just be like, I will never hear the words I long to hear from my mom. And I kind of moved on. And then it was 18 months ago, my girlfriend gave me a book, and I can't ever remember the title, but the subtitle is Healing for Daughters of Narcissistic Mothers. And it was there's a book, and there's a 33 question list. And if you get anywhere from 5 to higher, your mom's a narcissist. And all three of my sisters, it was like, I was 32, one sister was 31, and the other said 33, you know, so we're like, oh, clearly we were raised by a narcissist. And one of the exercises they say you should do in the book is to visualize your mother as a child and pull your mother on your lap. It's this whole like, woo, 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 you know, kind of thing. And by happenstance, what happened is at the same time, my aunt had found in her basement a whole ton of 8mm rolls of film. She had no idea what they were, but I'm like, hey, let me take them. I'll make copies for everybody. I popped the first one in, and it's a DVD of my mother as a little girl playing. And I just watched it. I was mesmerized by it. I watched about an hour of it. She was playing with other little kids, playing with her siblings. And it brought this feeling like, she does have a childlike wonder, or used to when she was young. And I just kind of let it wash over me and just let it go. I just let the whole thing go in a deeper way. Right. And I think that's what, has, you know, ultimately set me free, was just letting go and, not putting expectations on her when her brain isn't wired to fulfill those expectations. Once I realized it was a mental illness and not that she didn't like me, my whole heart shifted. And that was important. That was really important for me.
So one of the things you said earlier was that as a part of building this business into what it's become today, yeah, you held this belief system that you wake up every morning and do work with peace and passion. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how you've developed that belief system over time and how other people do that in their own lives and in their own work.
I think that my husband and I actually, when we were young, we started out and actually wound up moving to the Bay Area because we wanted to pastor a church, believe it or not. We'd been in kind of an abusive church situation in a small town in Northern California where the board at one time, my husband needed air conditioning. The sun would set on the west side of his office. It would get to 110 degrees in his office. And so someone proposed, let's get him some air conditioning. And one of the board members said, he's a Mexican. Get him a sombrero. And my husband and I were like, we need to get out of here. So we came down to the Bay Area thinking we would start a church where people actually loved each other and liked each other and did everything that the scripture says you should do. Just why don't we act like all the words in red that Jesus said? Let's just do those, you know? And so that was our original purpose of coming down here. Now we have our own little group that we shepherd, you know, here, and they're called Duarte and Duartians. And we decided to apply some of those principles from the scripture around love, around following your passion. I think you are hardwired. You're made with a destiny. And I think that destiny emerges when you follow your passion. And then the peace part is, you know, you should do things that bring peace and love and all those things. And so it's definitely grounded in our upbringing and in the words of Jesus. I don't love what Christians have come to represent by any means. I think Jesus's fans kind of screwed it up pretty bad. But that's where I'm rooted and tethered to, is showing love. And that's how it manifests. Love for what you do and love for others.
You mentioned that you're hardwired for destiny of some sort. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think it's interesting that you have become masterful at this one thing. And, you know, I'm wondering, does that exist in everybody's life? And how do they connect the dots to see what that one thing is that they're destined to do?
Well, and that's where I think it takes years to get there. That's what. Yeah. Why I do like to say, just wake up each day and do what brings you peace and passion. So like my son, he's an interesting example this guy who's just, he was a classically trained composer. He writes these beautiful classical music, decided that that for him is sacred and he didn't want to do that as his profession. So he's taught himself how to be a mechanical engineer and now he's making heart valves. Like, but what he does is he stays up till midnight every night and he's a hobby. He's doing his hobby, which is, believe it or not, building scale steam engines. He orders in the prints from the 1800s and builds these intricate steam engines. Why does he love that? I don't know. Like, am I ever going to bug him for doing this thing he's passionate about? No, because that hobby led him to enter, even though he's a composer, he's entering into organization at an engineer level. Like, how impossible is that? If he hadn't followed this passion, it's shaping who he becomes and what his craft is. You know what I mean? I don't think he would have said, I want to make heart valves, but he's doing what he's passionate about, which is this obscure little hobby, and it's opening up doors for him in a way that are unprecedented. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think that's what I mean. I think sometimes we can try. I can see the future pretty clearly. I'm a bit of a seer in the sense that I get an intuitive sense that my organization needs to be at a different place in the future. 18 months out, we need to look like this. We need to be doing these activities. We need to offer these services. I can just tell, right? Being the leader for so long, I can actually see a little bit of the future. But if I were to say in 20 years, I know for sure that this is my destiny. I think you have to take it one day at a time or that could become frustrating. And it's a little bit about, you know, what Illuminate's about. There was a whole body of work we did around that, this sense of if your organization is like an epic length tale that transcends leaders and everything, what is that thing? What is that purposeful thing that stays in place no matter where you go or what you become? And so we want to release that as possibly the next book. So we're building out that kind of purpose that would lead you to your destiny kind of a piece. And that'll be coming.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Design Crowd. So maybe the whole idea of designing things seems really intimidating to you, but it doesn't have to be, because that's where a service like Design Crowd comes in. They make the equivalent of an entire creative team accessible to you at a price that's affordable to anyone. And here's how it works. You go to designcrowd.com and you submit your design brief for whatever it is, whether it's a flyer, whether it's an ebook, whether it's a t-shirt, a logo, a website design. Then you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 designers from around the world. If you like what you get, you can then approve payment. Or you can go back to the crowd and ask for more, or you can ask for your money back. And because you're an unmistakable creative listener, you're getting $100 off of your first design project. So visit designcrowd.com/creative to see other things that other unmistakable creative listeners have had made using Design Crowd, and use the promo code creative at checkout for $100 off your first design project. Again, that's designcrowd.com/creative. Today's episode is also sponsored by our friends at HostGator, as always. And as I've mentioned to you in multiple episodes, one of the easiest ways to start on any creative project is simply to just build a website. Even if it's a really simple website with just a little bit of text about whatever your project is, that's how most of our projects have started here at Unmistakable Creative. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, you're getting 30% off all of your hosting packages. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, an easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech savvy. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off.
You know, another piece of this that I find really fascinating, and it's really relevant to the way I've been thinking about things, is you mentioned, you know, in the wake of the dot-com recession, you're like, that's it. We're going to cut all these services and we're going to do this one thing and we're going to do it exceptionally well. And there's another reason this is fresh on my mind. I don't know if you've read it, but a journalist named Leander Caney wrote a book called Inside Steve's Brain. And it's about, you know, Steve Jobs and his return to Apple. And there's a chapter titled How Saying No Saved Apple. And he talks about how basically he eliminated just about every single thing.
He made a four quadrant graphic and decided we'll only do these four products.
Yep. Exactly. And I mean, it sounds like you've done something similar.
Yep.
I found myself doing exactly that, saying, okay, we have three products, our newsletter, our podcast, and the book that's coming out. Everything else is a distraction. And that's it for the entire year. Mm-hmm. And yet I'm amazed by how difficult people find it to do that. And I'm wondering, as somebody who has done that and just let go of all those other things, you know, how you do that and how you bring that kind of focus and why that kind of focus creates the momentum that it does in your work.
No, you know, I I try to simplify. My people from the outside are like, oh my God, you're so busy. Like, they love to tell me that. Oh my God, you're so busy. Like, you know, because they'll be like, I had to wait four months to get on your calendar. And I'll be like, but I don't tell them. It's like, well, that's because I take Saturdays and Sundays off, three nights a week. I have no plans. My calendar is booked so I can write. So I only have a handful, maybe 5 hours a week I can give to other people and their needs or whatever, you know. And I think it's because I do protect it so I can produce. I know before we started this recording, we were talking about how I think both of us like to produce something every day. We like to put some words on the page or do something, and I protect that time. So I do cut a lot out. I would say I have a handful of very close friends. I don't have hundreds of very close friends, you know. Mm-hmm. I have really close relationships with my children and a handful of close friends, and then the rest of the time I'm pouring into my body of work. And I like that. I like spending my time that way. Mm. And CEOing right now, I'm the president of my firm. I had to step in and do that for a little bit, which has been kind of exhilarating.
Well, I think that makes a perfect setup to start specifically talking about your body of work. You know, where I want to start before we get into the communication piece and the tools and ideas in the book is about what has informed your perspective on design and the way you tell these stories so that they are so compelling and engaging.
You know, Wikipedia, someone keeps putting in there that I'm a presentation designer. Uh-huh. I think I finally figured out, I think it's because my TED Talk says that my title is a presentation designer. I am. And so my poor marketing guy has to go in there and keep taking it out. Someone keeps putting, and it also says I have a degree in math, which I don't know where these people get this information about me that's more insightful than my own bio, but I'm not a designer. What I am is I think I'm a systems thinker. I'm one who needs to be able to visually connect some dots. So if you click even from one slide to the next and you talk about the same thing over two slides, but you visually expressed them different, it's like, what an idiot. Don't do that, you know? And I just think I naturally could see visuals that fit into systems and highly valued making the complex simple. Because when you're a systems thinker, you can see the whole system, but how do you convey it in a way that makes it clear and simple and distilled? So I would say that's really what my gifting is. And then I guess maybe I was smart enough to attach myself to people who know how to visually express it in a way that's breathtaking. Mm-hmm. And so I do think everyone can develop the skill of thinking and distilling and cutting and trimming. But not everybody can actually visually express it to a level of beauty and distinction that I think my team can. Mm.
Well, so I have one question about the actual work you do and more importantly about the people that you've worked with. You know, I think the one that everybody knows you for, at least I do, is the Inconvenient Truth piece. And mm-hmm. I'm curious what you've learned about human behavior, psychology, motivation, and performance from working up close and personal with somebody like an Al Gore.
What was it like to work with them?
Yeah. I mean, what are the lessons in success and what enables that?
It's so fun. We worked with him for, I think, my dog. I have my little doggie here on my lap. She wasn't feeling good today. So, she just sneezed. Sorry about that. But Mr. Gore was amazing to work with. So we worked with him, I think it was 4 years before The Inconvenient Truth became a movie. In fact, when they contacted me and were like, we're making it a movie. I'm like, who's going to see a movie about a slideshow, right? How much did I not believe in my own body of work or whatever? But the lessons learned for me was we had never really worked with anyone of his stature and his power, right? Who we would propose something and then he would just sit and reflect for 10, 20 seconds. And then he'd be like, if you guys think that's the best way, yeah, let's do it that way, right? Whereas we could work with 22-year-old CEOs today who think they rule the world of visual display of information. Like, you know, it was just really telling how thoughtful and how much he deferred to us for our professional insights. And that was a real honor. And I also think I short sold, you know, my whole insight about, well, who wants to see a movie about a slideshow? That was so short-sighted because here I'd spent so many years building up the perception of what a great slideshow could do. And I didn't even believe myself that this would work. And just the fact that he traveled around the world creating a groundswell, like a lot of people don't realize that he did travel for like 4 years, like I was saying. he would go into these different geographies and try to find the people of greatest influence and gather them together, whether it was homes or small venues or whatever, and just repeatedly saying the message. And so by the time the actual movie came out, there was such a groundswell of support that it just kind of busted open. And watching that was really unbelievable. Hmm. Really unbelievable.
Well, I think that makes a perfect setup to get into what I want to spend the rest of our time talking about, which is the new book and specifically the Torchbearer's Toolkit, because I looked at all of these tools and I decided I was going to ask you an incredibly selfish question. So let's say that I wanted to take the concepts in the Torchbearer's Toolkit and apply them to the concepts that I am discussing in my new book that I'm coming out. If I were to translate that into a presentation, do you think we could walk through an example of what that would look like?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you'll tee up what the situation is or something?
Yeah. So let's say the concept is unmistakable. Why only is better than best. That's sort of the thesis. And I want to apply the tools from the Torchbearer's Toolkit to that idea. So that way we have a practical example to work with.
Yeah. So so what this book is about taking innovation and which would be maybe your book, and turning it into a movement. Like, how do you build the momentum and how do you actually see it executed? And so let's say you were trying to create a movement around something that's unmistakable. So the phases, since people may or may not have seen the book, the phases, we call it a venturescape. So that puts you as the leader of a venturescape. We position the leader as a torchbearer. And that's what you would be. You're the torchbearer and you have your travelers that need to make this journey with you. So those are the people you need to lead en masse to believe that your book is true, right? Mm-hmm. Or whatever is the premise or the thing that you're trying to move them through. So your travelers are going to go through a 5-step process. They need to understand the dream, then they're going to, which is like your moment of inspiration, and then they're going to make a leap. They're going to make a moment of decision. And then they have to fight. They have to be brave. They have to maybe defend your work. They have to maybe, get other people not to want to join your movement. And then they have to be able to navigate that. That's like a moment where there's this fog of war. And then they have to climb, which is the moment of endurance. And then they arrive, which is when you create a moment of reflection. So there's these moments along the movement where people need to hear speeches, stories, be part of ceremonies, and that create these symbols of meaning along the way. Well, this is the long game, you know. This isn't like by Tuesday. Sometimes in one day you can go through all 5 phases, but most of the time this is that whole longevity play. A lot of times an initiative is a year long, 2 years long, 18 months long, whatever long it is. And you walk your travelers, could be an audience, could be your employees, could be your customers, whoever that, your readership in your case, they're going to go through all of these phases. Because let's say you're trying to change their mindset. They're like, I got the dream. Your book may be the dream, right? Mm-hmm. They're like, I'm pretty committed to it. Then they start to apply it. So that's the dream leap. They start to apply it. It's a fight. They might try it for 2 days and give up. So your job would be to arm them with things that make them brave and keep them brave as they try to apply your principles. And they start to feel like, I just want to give up. I think actually making this come true is too hard. Then it's your job as a communicator to tell enough stories, give a speech, write a blog post, those things that keep them in the fight. And then they have to endure as they try to put it into practice. And that would also be your job as the communicator to make sure that they can endure. So ultimately they arrive transformed. It's a story structure. It's this likable person as they try to jump into change. It's hard. And then ultimately when they commit to it and see it through, they change. And so that's basically the structure, and that's how it would apply.
So I want to ask you specifically for examples from the book, and just so you know, we have a few more tactical things to work with, of speeches, stories, symbols, and ceremonies that have actually fueled movements.
Yeah, there's a bunch. So there's case studies in the book that are really appealing. So we wrote a case study for each phase. There's a dream case study, a leap case study, and we studied different companies: Interface Carpets, Starbucks. We took Dr. King's civil rights movement, but the Chicago campaign specifically, that movement, because there's little movements within a bigger movement. Steve Jobs, as he migrated all his developers from Mac OS 9 to 10, and Charity Water. And so in each case study, there's tons of speeches, stories, ceremonies, and symbols that they used as they're trying to transform people in mass. I don't know if one of those seems particularly interesting to you or not.
Let's do the charity water one, because I think people are probably familiar with that. The part that personally is very intriguing for me, like the speeches and the stories part, I get because I've been exposed to so many of them. I mean, what we do is effectively tell stories and have people give speeches here at Unmistakable Creative. I think the thing that's really interesting to me is the ceremonies and symbols, because it seems like that's a big mm-hmm. part of how, you know, people like Chris Guillebeau create what they do in the environments that they set up. You know, people like Tony Robbins. So I'd love to hear about how that applies in creating a movement.
Yeah. So ceremonies are very interesting. And I think that's one of the newer insights in the book, though we did come up with story plots that nobody's ever really discovered before. But ceremonies are based in the rites of passage. If you look back as far as you can to civilization, some of the earliest artifacts you can find were used in a form of a ritual. It was a ritualistic use of these little tools or artifacts, symbols, you can call them if you want. And I was like, wow, why is it that corporations don't intentionally do ceremony? And the ceremony you would do at each stage is very, very different, but it's part of the human condition because we're kind of wired for these. Mostly it's wired into the rites of passage. Almost every religion and culture has some sort of rites of passage. It's a bar mitzvah in the Hispanic cultures, it's a quinceanera. A wedding is a rite of passage. What happens is you show up, you're single, you go through a 10-minute ceremony, you're married. It's like, I'm not that anymore, and now I'm this, just because you went through a ceremony. Well, part of transformation at scale and creating a movement is letting go of the past and embracing the future. And a ceremony does that. It says, we're no longer this, and now we're that. And it helps everyone acknowledge that. Now, if you do it in a corporate setting, you could really screw this up. Like, it's pretty easy to screw it up. It has to actually come from the hearts of the people sometimes. Like, you know, some companies, maybe it was a merger and acquisition, and they just take the name of the company off the building and throw it in a dumpster and put the new company name up there. Well, that's the bad. That you could actually ceremonially, with grace, with honor, do a ceremony around pulling the old name off and putting the new one on. You know, so those become a ceremony. It's not a story. It's a ceremony. And I think one of the funnest, most interesting ones in the book was when Steve Jobs was trying to get all the developers to move from macOS 9 to 10. macOS 10 is what next. That's why they bought his company, was to get a new operating system. And yet the developers were pretty entrenched and skeptical because they'd been on a 10-year journey with Apple without a strategy. And so they just didn't believe that Apple could actually stick to a strategy. Well, he'd been working with them for 3 years, and there were still some developers incredibly skeptical. And he already had a new dream of the future where macOS 10 was this hub. There's a speech he gave where he talked about macOS 10 being a hub. It's called the digital hub strategy. And he had this vision. Everything's hooked up to macOS 10, doggone it. You need to move on to 10. So he wanted to – that speech is fascinating because about the next decade of Apple products was foreshadowed in that speech. It's pretty amazing. So it's a pretty big dream he had, but the developers are still bitching about 9 and not wanting to move to 10, right? And so he opened up WWDC 2002 with a funeral, a mock funeral. Smoke came out from under the stage, a coffin raised up, stained glass went up on the slides, and Steve Jobs walks out with an oversized box of macOS 9. He walks over to the coffin, puts it in it, closes the lid, puts a rose on top of it, and eulogizes macOS 9. That's not a speech. It's not a story. It was a ceremony. He did, and it was a funny eulogy, which was good because people that were there that I've talked to were like, initially, it was kind of creepy, but then it was like, you know what? We're over it. It's done. And it sent a very clear message to the developers in the room that can't, no going back. It's dead. He never addressed macOS 9 again, ever. It was done. It was done in his mind and his heart. And the developers that did not move on missed out. And he wanted to send a really clear symbol, a really clear message, about that. And so it's just in the charity water, because you wanted an example of that. Scott Harrison's Charity Water, is his whole nonprofit is just steeped in storytelling. He's such a good storyteller. And gosh, I just Sorry about that. My computer just beat me. And so what happened was that one of the ceremonies he did, it's a ceremony of empathy. What he did is when you are in a poor country, a lot of times the women have to walk 8 hours a day and carry a jerry can, a 35-pound jerry can that's usually used for diesel fuel. They carry a 35-pound jerry can up to 8 hours a day just to get water for their family. And what Scott did is he created this ceremony at these fundraisers. He calls it a walk. He calls it a water walk, a gala walk, or I don't know the exact name of it, but he sets up a catwalk, basically like a runway. And he has these jerry cans full of water, 35 pounds each sometimes, and asks you to pick it up and just walk like 20 feet, not 8 hours, just walk 20 feet with these jerry cans full of water. And what it does is it makes you go, Oh my God, I see things from their perspective. I can't do this. Like, I couldn't even pick two up. I had to use two hands to carry one. And then I went and hired a trainer to help me. But that is a ceremony. That's an immersive ceremony. So in the toolkit in the book, the dream phase, it says the ceremony you need to do there is an immersive ceremony, which is foreshadows baptism, say, which is a ceremony. You dip underwater and you come out changed. Well, that's what Scott's created. He created an immerse deeply ceremony, which is I pick up these cans, I try to lift them, and I'll never be the same again. I have been immersed in the lives of these women, you know, and that's how you catch. That's one way he set up a ceremony so you could catch his dream of clean drinking water for everybody in the world.
Wow. So I have two last questions for you.
Sure.
This capacity to incorporate ceremonies, stories, and speeches to ignite change and create movements in such a way that is so compelling and effective to the people that you're trying to move. Do you think that can be learned and developed? And do you think there are people that are just inherently good at it naturally without even knowing what they're doing? And if you can develop it, what have you seen as patterns in people who have evolved in that?
I think there's some people that are naturals at it. And I feel like the case studies in the book were definitely people who were natural at it. My favorite kinds of response we're getting to the book is, oh my gosh, Nancy, I feel like scales just fell off my eyes because for the first time ever in my life, I can see things from the perspective of my employees, or I can see things from the perspective of my clients. So the model, well, the VentureScape model in the book itself is actually a graphic of empathy. It's like, holy cow, I can see now that they're in a struggle. I never really realized that asking my employees to change is a struggle and that it's a fight for them and that they're picking up my battle cry, right? And that's my favorite thing. And so that's why, like, I had a really difficult talk I needed to do with my own team. And this sounds narcissistic. Maybe I'm more like my mom than I thought. But I whipped open the toolkit and I processed it. I processed it. And I was like, because we were in the fight phase. And I felt like during the fight phase, I had a casualty, for lack of a better word. And I pulled it out. And I was like, what do my people need to hear from me as a leader? And I did this little inventory. I was on an airplane and I outlined a beautiful talk. And oddly, if I didn't have this book, I would have taken that a different direction. So while we were writing the book, it was interesting. My own organization was going through a pretty big change. And one driven by me, it was to help get us global ready and all this stuff. And as we were writing it, I would say, oh my goodness. Like, there were some poignant moments where I would get misty-eyed with my co-author. We would both just sit there and be like, this is too real. It's too poignant. Because we were like, this totally applies to us right now. And we could see it so clearly. And so the whole thing, this whole experience of writing this book was surreal and fun. So I guess my short answer should have been, yes, I think it can be taught. And yes, I do think some people are just naturally better at it than others. But I think everyone that leads should care enough about their team to consider their perspective and communicate from there.
Hmm. Well, this has been incredible. As I expected it would be. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
You know, I think it's when they're comfortable being different. I think that I'm different, right? And I just kind of let it hang out there. And I think you have to be able to be comfortable being free from caring that you're judged. You know, it's like, It's like I put it out there and people may be like, oh my God, I can't believe she talked about her mother, you know? And it's like, you know what? It shaped me. It's what made me unmistakable. And that's what I think it would be. I think just don't care that people may judge and be comfortable being different.
Well, this has been really phenomenal, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your insights and your story with our listeners. I will probably be playing this interview 100 times every time I prepare for a presentation, much like I do with yours and Gar's books. I'll probably listen to this interview.
Oh, you've been so good. This was a blast.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, I will link up everything that Nancy had mentioned in the show notes, and we will wrap the show with that.
Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
So there's lots of ways. There's kind of two ways of dealing, expanding boundaries. One is external factor and external stimuli. Drugs would be an obvious example, right? But it's that's a temporary thing. A more sustained approach would be to do internal transformation, meditation, martial arts, NLP type programs, biofeedback increasingly. And we're starting to develop very interesting technologies to transform the inner self. And so a combination of those two gives you that possibility.
We revisit our conversation with Executive Director from Singularity University, Salim Ismail.